Hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Fine.
Good evening.
Great. I had some questions that were sent in, two of which by Allison will probably not be answered in the course of the seminar, so I wanted to address those first and then to take other questions or comments or things you'd like us to discuss. The first question is, do you have a list of effective best questions? I have instead a list of some principles, because I don't really operate from a list of best questions because I make them up as I go, but they're based on principles that I can share with you. I believe that productive communication between two people takes place through dialogue, conversational exchange, in which what one says is contingent on what the other just said. And this back and forth dialogue is informed by asking powerful questions because that directs focus, but also the mentor-coach process is one of collaborative contingent conversation, meaning collaborative in that both parties make contributions in an ongoing interaction and conversations, and contingent in that there's no agenda or no script or no list of questions, because what each person says is a response to what the other just said and vice versa. So think about an intense conversation or a really engaged conversation with a good friend. You don't have a list of questions. You're engaged. You're immersed in that process. And you could later deconstruct some of what you said or the principles of that, but you're so engaged that those inform you at the time, they don't direct you. So the focus is entirely on immersion in the conversation with the client. Now, recognizing that, there are some various kinds of interactions that we have in addition to asking powerful questions. And I want to just kind of bullet a few of those, because even though the principle here is asking powerful questions, because that focuses the client's attention on his or her own issues and makes the client a point of reference and engages to look at possibility of something that's not preformed, but in looking at it in new ways. But that's a principle. It's not a rule. It's not something we rigidly adhere to only ask questions. So here are some things that some coaching interactions to create effectiveness and mastery that we engage in other than asking powerful questions. We endorse. We endorse the client's concepts and ideas and look at acknowledging insight, reflection on different circumstances. Sometimes we mirror. We hold a mirror to someone to help them see themselves better. Sometimes we summarize. Sometimes we reframe to look at things in a different perspective. Sometimes we brainstorm. Sometimes we offer ideas and insights. Sometimes we strategize. Sometimes we simply explain something to a client that they, because of their immersion in their own story and their experience, may not be able to extract themselves, or even with our encouragement, to look at that from a different perspective. Sometimes we advise. We may encounter a client with a blind spot or something that they simply aren't able to engage for various reasons. Sometimes we story bust. We question or challenge automatic habitual behavior or limiting assumptions. Sometimes we just give information. If somebody doesn't know what an AMWA is, you can't coach it out of them. They may need guidance toward resources and information. Sometimes we train and redirect, for example, a model of how to handle conflict, including communication skills. And sometimes we help someone regulate states of mind. And that we talked about in last seminar, and I hope each of you have received the neuroconditioning worksheet that I did as a follow-up to that. Now, the other question is, how would you coach people who have had forced change as opposed to planned change? And I'll do this very briefly. Remember, in the first seminar, we talked about each person has a unique sequence of basic responses, both to change and to transition. And while these may be fundamental steps and stages of both change and transformation, the abruptness and the external origin of a change when it's happened to someone, such as a forced change, a divorce that someone didn't see coming, a job loss someone didn't see coming, the external origin of the change may mean that more emotion is in the foreground, and it may thrust this aspect, and especially the emotional components, into a more prominent position to work on. So that may mean that that may guide what we do first rather than engage in the strategy and all the stages and that sort of thing. So we need to empathically resonate first, always, with the client's experience, and we may need to linger there a bit longer because there may need to be some work done about just the emotional impact and the suddenness and the aspects of that. So that may guide some of the sequencing of what we deal with. I think the fundamental aspects of transition will all be dealt with, but the sequence may change depending not only on the individual, but whether it's internal or external, and especially if there's no prep work, if there's no preparatory experience like it was thrust on somebody. So, I hope that's a decent beginning to that answer. Are there other thoughts about that or other questions that some of you have or things that you'd like to talk about? Anybody want to elaborate on your own ideas about those? Anything else that you would like for us to discuss as a group before we move into the topic for today? And I appreciate the questions and the responses that you send. They're very helpful to me in hearing what your thoughts are, your responses, and guiding some of where I direct some of the discussion. Anything else? Okay, well, I'm going to move to lecture mode, and I'll save some time at the end for us to discuss. We're going to talk in this seminar about road mapping a new story. And remember, I talked about roadmap is the system of the seven steps, the acronym for the seven steps that are about a way of deconstructing an understanding of a client story and of reconstructing, of creating a new story or revision of the story. We're all defined by the stories we tell ourselves. In coaching, we help clients assess, is your story empowering you or causing you to fall short? Is your story limiting any area of your life? Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago or the one that focuses on problems to overcome. Here's a quick quiz. What is the number one addiction that we have as humans? And think about it. The most common addiction that humans have. Problems are the biggest addiction we have. They give us an effective focus. They allow us to escape our own fear. Happiness is when your life conditions match your blueprint. Now think about that. That's simple. It may be a little convoluted, but it's still simple. Happiness is when your life conditions match your blueprint, how you feel life should be. If you're unhappy, your life condition doesn't match your blueprint, what you expect. For a different result, you have to change one or the other. You have to change your life or change your blueprint. To change the long term, you have to change the blueprint, the map that may have become outdated if it creates anything less than happiness. So now let's look at how to change a blueprint. This is the roadmap for a new story. Remember, the acronym for the seven steps to deconstruct the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. The mind and brain behavior, let me say it a different way. The mind, brain, and behavior for changes for whatever story the client's writing, life story, wellness story, money, career, relationship, I'm going to present a brief overview of these 7 steps. And this entire process, including the exercises and work pages to help a client address those changes and write a new story, are part of the, I want to give you just an overview of some of the training I do for the licensed specialty certified New Life Story Wellness Coaches and New Money Story Mentor Training. And this is where that's taken from. So this will, I've included a sample of some of the exercises and work pages in the accompanying workbook to the seminar series in the curriculum that you have that I hope you find useful. So we're going to look at the 7-step roadmap process to effectively facilitate a significant change. The 7 steps, again, to deconstruct an understanding of a story in a systematic way to construct a new one. Recognize authorship of your story. Own the present story. And again, whether this is wellness, career, life, money, relationship. 3rd, assess the storylines and plot. Decide what to keep, enhance, let go, and avoid. Map changes. Author new experiences, and program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. So one way to apply this is to roadmap a new story. Let's discuss this from the perspective of working with clients, and let's talk about a roadmap that would apply to our topic, change and transition. So to apply the roadmap, let's use the example of career transition. Step 1. And this is just an illustration. Step 1, recognize your career story. If you were to configure it as a shape, what would it be? A trajectory, a circle, a bell curve, a flat line? Clearly describe your career story as it exists now. Then describe what you want in your career story. If someone wants to make a career change, are they fully informed about the one they're in now and wanting to leave? For example, if someone has only performed at 80 or 85% capacity, concluded that their job or career is not rewarding, then decide to move on, they don't have the information that they need to make a decision. They can't make an informed decision of what it's like to operate at 100% capacity. To do an apples-to-apples comparison, they would have to function at 100% of their capacity in their current career and contrast it with the anticipation of 100% capacity in a new career. It's likely that the same process that resulted in a ceiling at 80% will be repeated in the new situation. So here are some questions to ask about that. At what percent of your capacity are you functioning in your work now? And always, surprising to me still, somebody immediately has the answer. No one yet has ever had to think about that. They'll immediately say 60% or 85%. They will instantly know, as if that was a question pre-submitted to them. They thought about it. It's always amazing to me. So if it's not 100%, explore why. That's your immediate coachable moment. Another question, have you ever performed at 100% of your capacity? In other words, do you know what it's like to be fully successful at your current or past position so you can make an informed decision? Here's a brief story to illustrate. At the beginning of my career as a psychiatrist, for a small part of my professional time, when I was on the faculty at Baylor College of Medicine, I served as consultant for the Institute of Rehabilitation and Research, working with people who had become physically disabled in adolescence or adulthood, often as a result of an accident. This is the same facility that Representative Gabby from Arizona came to and spent several months after the shooting. Not surprisingly, some of these individuals considered suicide as an alternative to a lifetime of disability. Instead of trying to convince them to not kill themselves, I indicated that I could understand their feelings about the overwhelming change in their life. Suicide was at least one way they could control something about their life, especially when fundamental body control was out of reach. I recognized that at that moment in time, the idea of suicide, of being able to control one thing in their lives, to know that they could end the pain, was the hope that paradoxically allowed them to keep living. They needed that choice. They needed to be effective in that potential way. I recommended that we work together to achieve their full capacity now, recognizing that it was at a different level since the onset of disability. At the same time, they were working with a full treatment team at the rehabilitation center. Only achieving their full potential in their new level could they make an informed decision about whether they truly wanted to live or not live as a physically challenged individual. I told them that I would entirely understand if, after achieving full capacity and then being able to make an informed decision, if they decided to die, I would respect that decision. I worked with several hundred people over a period of 5 years. Thankfully, no one decided to die after going through full physical and emotional rehabilitation and achieving a new, though different, level of function. Step two, own your career story, especially your needs and ideals. Be clear about needs and ideals. There, and that, those two exercises are in your workbook. If and how they align with passion and experience. When your passion and expertise combine, wonderful possibilities emerge. So a question here, what do you want in your career? And listen for whether the client is getting away from something or going towards something, or rarely both. Distinguish temporary frustration from permanent dissatisfaction. Be cautious about confusing dissatisfaction, disillusionment, or even burnout with terminal disillusionment. Before you can distinguish temporary from permanent, you may have to realign or recommit to your career. And keep in mind that choosing the wrong career may be every bit as easy as it was the first time if you chose the wrong career then. One client spoke of a particular storyline that she had bought into. She was not addicted to work itself or to money or the things that money bought, but she was addicted to the pursuit of perfection. And that seemed reasonable, given her work ethic. More had become a goal. More money, more work. The story of the pursuit of money had become a substitute for other stories. The ideal of more, of course, lacks an endpoint, so her self-esteem could never be validated. More and perfect don't have an endpoint, so they're not really goals. She had become exhausted with the perpetual series of occasions for hope of being perfect, yet never quite getting there. Keep her in mind. I'm going to return to her situation in just a moment. Step three, assess your career story. Remember, we talked a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain, a physical part of a neuronal network. A teacher can't simply present an explanation and remove an existing neural network from his student's brain. You can't just list three reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange someone's neural networks and pathways, or that presenting a new fact is going to overwrite the ones already there. But change can occur as a process, not an event. It's an inside job. So this step to assess beliefs to see if they're limiting and try out other beliefs. What's another way to look at this? How might my thoughts be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there questions I'm afraid to ask? At some level, you know what they are because the answer always pushes out the question. Remember, denial is a powerful engagement. So is the secret. What do I really want? And what do I need to let go of? So, what is present and what is missing in a current career? What information do you need? You may need to research new information regarding personal skills, abilities, aptitudes. So some questions here. What would your career and life be like if you already had what you wanted? What is it costing you personally and financially to not have what you want? And I think it's important to distinguish internal dissatisfaction from job dissatisfaction, because it's too easy to have it light on the job as if that's the cause rather than just a manifestation. Internal struggles and unhappiness are often blamed on a job, or at times a marriage. People want to change the obvious external cause rather than to look inside. Sometimes people even create job-related struggles to externalize unhappiness or conflict in an attempt to escape or simply to pose a recognizable remedy, to have it light on something that makes it make sense. Then the supposed way to get rid of the problem is to leave it. Step 4, decide on a plan and how to make it work. You have to learn to develop yourself. You decide where you can make the greatest contribution. You want to stay informed and engaged at whatever you do, although it may be different than what you have done for 3 or more decades. It may be different now than what it was for the last 3 decades. It means that you will examine again your fundamental strengths, your needs, your ideals. Perhaps for the first time, and this is the case of so many people who I've trained to become coaches or licensed specially certified coaches, you will for the first time be self-directed, self-organized. You will work for yourself. No corporate structure or job to fit into and govern your day. You will need to cultivate a deep understanding of yourself, your strengths and weaknesses, how you learn, how you work with others, and especially where you can make the greatest contribution. At the other end of a career, a buddy of mine and I do a weekend retreat called What's Next Exec. It's for current CEOs and business owners who are within a year or so of retirement and absolutely know that they're not going to be happy playing golf every day. That'll last about 2 months. So we look at the whole process of change and transition. What's next for them? What career transition do they want to make? What contribution do they want to make? So here's a question for you, for this client. How would working with me get you where you want to be? So to return to this client pursuing perfection, the one I mentioned moments ago, her medical practice was booming, yet she wasn't enjoying it or feeling fulfilled, only looking to the next task to do perfectly. I highlighted this pattern when we had evidence of it. It seemed that as soon as she began enjoying her work, really immersed in it, that she began procrastinating. She would put off completing work, which restored her old feeling and vague guilt about what she should be doing. When I pointed out this pattern, she immediately recognized it. It prompted her insight. She said, work always needed to be work. The minute I began to feel pleasure at work, I started feeling vaguely guilty, like I should be working. So, one possibility, create a vision. Create a vision of success at your specific goals. Include all sensory detail, all experience of successfully arriving at your goal. Review it twice a day. Having a plan supersedes motivation and not feeling like doing something. For example, if your plan is that every Monday from 3 to 5 p.m. you work on your marketing, you may not feel like it, you may not be motivated, but if it's Monday and if it's 3 o'clock, you stick to your plan. 5, map, and you do not have to be motivated to do something. All you have to have is a plan and to stick to it. 5, map a new story, where, when, how to begin, SMART goals, initiatives, next best action, and navigate with the brain's error detection mechanism. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center of the brain that says this isn't normal when we try something new. So, when our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become hardwired and automatic. Then we notice when something doesn't fit into a predicted pattern. This error detection mechanism in the brain functions to compare our input with what we expect. A mismatch creates a disruption in the expected order of things. So the error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamics. We focus on differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on things we do wrong while struggling to list our strengths. this is part of why we focus so much on problems. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before consideration, placing another barrier to resist change. This is one of the reasons why telling a client what to do may not work. It triggers the error detection mechanism. Another, focusing on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. Think about how easy it is to focus on problems, how that becomes almost the default mode. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason. That's why news leads with what bleeds, why everybody on the freeway slows down to rubberneck at an accident. The mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, such as stress or in childhood, may not apply in usual situations. The hardwiring is not permanent, though, and it can be revised. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, such as with collaborative, contingent conversations, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. The roadmap is simply one way to understand a systematic approach to this. So, the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, here's some compelling research that validates the impact of having a specific goal. Now, it's not exactly the research from a white coat, sterile medical laboratory, but it's kind of close. So if you're ready, the image of a black housefly was etched into each urinal at the Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. The theory was that while men may not pay attention to where they aim, if they have a specific target, a goal, they will focus more specifically. The theory of the originator, Ad Kaboom, proved correct. It reduced spillage by 80%. Choice architecture is an art and a science. People can be nudged toward decisions that will improve their lives in healthy and wealthy directions. We are susceptible to biases that can lead us to make decisions, though, that are unhealthy or uneconomical or short-sighted. When we consider how people think, we can design environments of choice that make it easier for people to pick better options, which is exactly what we do in coaching. We look at choice architecture, and we specialize in change. Step 6, author changes. Implement the plan. Reach a goal. Here's something that we often don't quite consider, or maybe consider enough in coaching. Someone needs the correct paradigm. Changing careers means changing paradigms. A mistake of extrapolation would be to assume that the present experience would apply to a new career, you just change the setting. Now, here's an example, and this is from a coaching client. Even if you go from head of HR at one large multinational oil company to another in the same city, the culture is worlds apart. The correct paradigm would be not only the process, but the content of the new career as well as the process of change. Assumptions within a paradigm need to be examined for correctness. And the culture of the company, everything is different. Here's another example. In making a transition from medical practice to coaching, I assumed getting clients would be similar to getting therapy in analytic patients. For me, that was to share my work and thinking, to teach, to occasionally present a paper or write a book. My secretary would take the calls, put patients on the waiting list, and we'd schedule. Well, wrong for coaching. Coaching is a profession, but it's also a business. Marketing is a world of difference. My mentor coach drugged me kicking and screaming into marketing until I finally took the advice of my favorite grandmother, if you're not enjoying it, you're not doing it right. So, a question here, who else needs to be involved in your plan? Step 7, program new experiences and then incorporate them into your identity. Both the change and the transition involve changing a core identity. Remember, we've talked that the most one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is that we always return to our identity. So unless that core identity, the model of who and what we are, evolves and transforms along with the changes that we make, the changes won't last. We'll revert to the old, which is important to remember in working with clients. Your identity is the story you tell yourself about yourself, what you're willing to consider, what you'll do, what you won't do. Identity is a set of beliefs that relate to who you are as a person, what you can do and what you will and won't do. When changes don't last, someone has not evolved their identity to correspond with the behavioral changes. When there's a shift in identity, it becomes permanent. So, when we stay consistent with our own personal definition, that offers a continuity and an evolution of our identity. Not what you do, but who you are. So, some comments now about successful and productive work. These are some principles, I believe, related to what we're considering here, career transition, that I've come to see and wanted to conclude this part with. One, time is not an adequate measure of hard work. Two, hard work is not an adequate measure of performance or success. Three, and these are in your outline, a work ethic is not the same as a productivity or success ethic. Four, if possible, delegate everything other than what you do uniquely well. Time management is energy management. Stress regulation is energy management. Follow your passion. Know your optimum state of mind, your zone to accomplish each specific task. Know how to enter your optimum state of mind, how to get to your zone. When your passion and your expertise combine, deciding possibilities occur. Structure gives you freedom. And finally, and this is from the What's Next Exec Seminar, if you're thinking of retiring, consider retirement as a new career. What is the mission and purpose, the business plan? The difference your wisdom will make in your new career, whatever that is. Finally, consider the possibility. When you reach a point in your life that you can celebrate the freedom to work rather than freedom from work, that's success. So, let's look now at operating systems. Behavior patterns and belief systems downloaded especially from parents in the first years of life become automatic. They operate without observation or awareness. We touched on this before. Neuroscientists estimate that up to 95% of our behaviors and core beliefs are pre-programmed in the unconscious mind and operate on autopilot, unconsciously. We rarely ever observe these direct patterns and only see derivatives of behavior, and the beliefs and the operating systems are what's unconscious. So that may give rise to two stories simultaneously that go in opposite directions. And this is something I want to emphasize as a way of listening to clients. If their surface story is different from the shadow story, or if all of them believe the surface story, they may not need you. The surface story, I want to generate more income and create wealth. The shadow story that may ghostwrite behavior, well, I don't really think I can make big money, or I don't have what it takes, or I anticipate making a lot of money being really, really challenging, and I wouldn't know what to do with it. Another example, a stated or a surface story. I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story. Well, I really can't have total authority because my spouse acts like I'd be taking it away from him or her. Now, mentoring requires us to be insightful, reflective, and self-observant, to have mindfulness of ourselves in order to be empathically attuned to the mind and experience of the client. Considerations of a career need to be considered in conjunction with developmental phases of the individual within that career, as well as where the individual is in life development. needs and ideals need to be considered in terms of life phase. The developmental issues more in the foreground of a certain life phase may determine how someone views a career, or the challenges, or the desire to change careers. So, some ongoing assessment is necessary. Once a plan is put into action, we need to still do some things. One, monitor your choices. Two, question your ideas. Three, probe your reasoning. And ask clearly and honestly, does it work? So here are some mentor coaching applications. Here's how we can translate this into mentor coaching. Challenge your mindset. For example, see every task as an improvable skill and how you can get better rather than just getting it done. Approach work with new perspectives. Think more simply, more abstractly, deeper, more synthetically. Think long term. The place of your work in a system rather than simply a job. Get feedback from other sources, multiple sources, including outside your field. And do these approaches consistently. It's what distinguishes superachievers. I want to consider a notion of a destination postcard. A picture or scene from the not-too-distant future shows specifically what's possible. This is not a life goal or a career goal, but a destination postcard. This is for travel along the way. This application of visualization is a short-term vision, a way station toward an ultimate visualization or destination. It offers specificity to the belief of arriving and provides hope as a destination. So remember the two questions, the travel agent questions of how your brain works. Where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? Programming your brain can have both short-term and long-term destinations. A destination postcard is an interim goal in the process of getting to your ultimate goal, your ultimate visualization. So, script the critical moves pointed to the destination. Make the changes consistent with your identity. Focus on the next step. Build habits to optimize efficiency, and visualize the entire experience, ultimately, of successful arrival. So, and this is kind of bread and butter, just looked at from a slightly different perspective of what we do as coaches, to engineer effectiveness. Let's review some of the essentials of engineering effective change. And these are the fundamental steps. One, focus specifically on the next step. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg and his running style was a shuffle and a hop, he managed about 24 miles a day and completed the run in 143 days. Immediately after the race, he was interviewed and asked how he kept going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead. His response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. Two, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. Specify. Three, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going. This allows you to measure progress along the way and to tell what's detour and distraction. This is why maps are so useful. Four, make progress measurable. Demystify the journey, a specific destination, and a tangible focus on the next step. Five, make progress visible. Small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible. And celebrate each one with your client, each small victory. A best example of shrinking a task to a tangible next item is probably Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. And it becomes a series of effectiveness then, but one step at a time. A small target leads to small victories. The essence of effectiveness, the cumulative experience of mastery. So, in looking at it this way, all you ever have to do is the next right thing. This shrinks change to immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. So, what we've done now is to adopt the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry generates discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. So what I want to focus on now with you is to look at the AAA principles of change. This is kind of a summarization of change. The AAA principles of change to author a transition story. And the three A's, the AAA's, awareness, acceptance, and action. And there are 12 steps. One, you're writing your own story. Is it working? For each component, what are the results? Honestly assess each of these storylines with a question, is it working? And make that a yes or no. Your personal wellness story, mind, body, and spirit. Your business career story. Your relationship story. Your money story. A not-so-secret to success is that you have to pay in full for that success. So you might as well find out what the price is. Pay it in full, pay it as soon as possible, and then enjoy the benefits of success. The price is always some form of energy, whether that energy is money, time, work, or experience. If you get something for which you haven't provided value or benefits, you'll still have to pay in some way. An example is debt. You pay with a credit card, you don't have the money. You simply end up paying more for what you bought. Another non-secret. People who truly enjoy getting what they want are those who find a way to enjoy paying the price. This makes it easy to pay. The price is whatever you need in order to generate exactly what you want. Two, you're writing your own story. It takes just as much energy to create any belief in your story. Positive or negative, past, present, future, adaptive or maladaptive, the same energy. The belief of scarcity, for example, takes just as much energy as abundance. You generate the energy and give power to your story. When you use your attention to focus on what you don't have, you deplete your energy to engage what you do. Here's the subtle but crucial distinction. You give specific power to your story, and it assumes a momentum and power of its own. And remember, you're not the subject of that process. You're the creator of it. Here's a short list of some results when you focus on what you don't want. Fear, anxiety, anger, confusion, annoyance, helplessness, guilt. Three, you're writing your own story. Decide what you want. The primary reason people don't get what they want is they're not sure what they want. Here's a neuroscience law of attraction question. How does the brain work like a travel agent? The first two questions a travel agent asks. Where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? A map, a goal is like MapQuest. You program in where you want to go. You make a map and determine the time. A caveat. To know what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. And to say that a different way, you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And what you resist, you draw toward you. Resistance is an engagement. It's kind of like saying that anger is as passionate an attachment as love. They're both powerful attachments. An example of this principle I still like the quote, even if it's not exactly an example. Paul Conrad, political cartoonist, said of Charles Coughlin, a 1940s radio preacher, "I knew that anybody who had to holler that loud couldn't be right." If you find yourself resisting change, it's already occurred. And most suffering is a result of resisting what already is. People resist going to the doctor, but they aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. 4, you're writing your own story. Do you have specific, measurable goals? In a Harvard study begun in the mid-1950s, 10 to 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates fashioned a vision and specific goals for their life and business. 5 decades later, those 10 to 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. And this has been replicated in other longitudinal studies, including more recently Dartmouth undergraduates. Similar percentages, even more extreme, actually. Motivation increases as soon as you're clear about the goal and the payoff. Focus enhances when you have a specific plan and strategy. It's estimated that about 10% of people have less than 10% of people have measurable goals. 100% of people, though, have good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal, measurement and time, where and when, the travel agent questions. Here's a good idea. I'd like to lose weight. Here's a goal. I will reach 185 pounds by 5 p.m. March 15th, 2015. Here's a good idea. I want to save some money for retirement. Here's a goal. I will pay myself first by setting up an automatic transfer of $350 to my retirement fund from my checking account the first day of each month. Then write a breakthrough goal, something that would stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, move you to a higher level, a quantum leap, getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list, spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs, and every August riding on the coast of Maine. Now, you guys will have to substitute your own goals there. Then reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. 5, you're writing your own story. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. So, divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Just go to the next telephone pole. 6, you're writing your own story. Be consistent in the pursuit of your goals. It takes 25 to 30 days to etch a new pathway in your brain to make it permanent. Write your story consistently for it to become the default mode. The difference between a genius idea and a true story of success, Malcolm Gladwell tells us in Outliers, is about 10,000 hours of dedicated work to develop mastery. Now, guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart. It's that I stay with problems longer. That was Albert Einstein. 7, you're writing your own story. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't working will become evident and self-perpetuating. Now, this is all so simple. Good parents have known this for centuries. Sometimes it just takes human science and cognitive research to remind us of the obvious. The caveat, you have to take action to diminish pre-programmed responses and to write new script for new experiences. A new story has to replace the old one, and there are no shortcuts. Since long-term change requires consistent practice, repetition, to groove new neuronal pathways and establish new neural networks. But there are effective and efficient methods to accelerate optimum change and ensure transformations. 8, you're writing your own story. Ask for feedback to your spouse or partner. On a scale of 1 to 10, rate the quality of our relationship. If you do this, you can get direct feedback and learn what you can address. To your employees or colleagues, on a scale of 1 to 10, how am I doing? And then, how can I get to 10? A tribe in southern Africa called the Bemba has an interesting practice. When they hear a story of a person doing something wrong, something that destroys the social net of their tight community, all work in the village halls. The people gather around the offender and one by one recite all that that person has done right in his life. Good deeds, responsible behavior, thoughtful acts. This honest feedback on misbehavior has a time-honored consequence to allow the person to reclaim the better part of himself, to reframe the incident in terms of his life. He remembers who he is and why he is important to the life of the village. This may have been an original 360-degree feedback. Now, even without this kind of social network and feedback, we can relax and remember our way back into alignment with our true selves. We can get centered and reconnect with our essence. Now, a sidebar here. You may have noticed that each of these AAA principles of change to author a new story begins the same way. You're writing your own story. That's the first four steps of the roadmap. Recognize, observe, assess, decide, compressed into the shorthand of awareness and acceptance. The third A, mapping change and authoring new experiences in 12 action steps. 9, you're writing your own story. Get success insurance instead of waiting for good luck. Luck is defined as probability taken personally, or my favorite, narcissism meets chance. A review of research on goal writing, and this is in the work pages of your outline, helps us understand two essential components: why people give up on goals, and how effective goal setting can help ensure long-term achievement. I would say review those six most important reasons people give up on goals, because the inverse is success insurance, and they become important as you work in mentor coaching with your clients. 10, you're writing your own story. Take a chance. You didn't have a New York Times bestseller before you sent your manuscript to an agent. If you get it rejected, you still don't. So what you got to lose? What's the problem? You spent your whole life not having a New York Times bestseller. A young chiropractor, just out of professional school, wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. He was told he'd never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people who live in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes, talked to 6,500 people. He asked 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours from 7 to 9 or 5 to 7 in the afternoon? And which newspaper should I advertise in? He added, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? In the first month, he took in $72,500. In his first year, he netted over $1 million. 11, you're writing your own story. It's never too late to start. Don't let conventional wisdom or limiting assumptions ghostwrite your story. Cliff Beyond was a 61-year-old Australian sheep herder. He heard about a cross-country race from Sydney to Melbourne and decided to enter. He showed up in Oshkosh overalls and work boots. The officials looked at him like he was crazy. They said, this is a race of over 800 kilos. The most seasoned runners in the world compete. Do you have any running experience and equipment? He said, yeah, I run after my sheep every day, and I got these boots and this baseball cap. So when the race began, the world-class runners took off as they were trained to begin, and Cliff started shuffling along in his boots. Well, you're supposed to run 18 hours and sleep 6, but nobody told Cliff this. When the other runners were sleeping, he just kept shuffling along. They were all asleep and couldn't tell him. So he just shuffled along for almost 4 days. He cut 5.5 hours off the world record. We each have beliefs that limit us. Find the story that will improve you and start believing that. If there were no barriers, what would your ideal life be? And 12, you're writing your own story. everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. Ed Lorenz conceptualized chaos theories in the 1960s in this way. The initial state of events may seem unrelated and random, but eventually a pattern emerges, and in the end, all the pieces fit together. It's the study of phenomena that appear random, but in fact have an element of regularity which can be described eventually, perhaps using a different organizing perspective. In the end, all the pieces fit together. Okay, we're now in discussion mode. I'm interested in what you think and what you'd like to talk more about, or some of your own perspectives on this. Yes, go ahead, please.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the principle of structure gives you freedom.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing because the echo. Would you say that again, please?
Is that better? Can you hear me better?
Yes, someone. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on the principle of structure gives you freedom.
Structure what?
Gives you freedom.
I'm sorry, I'm just not able to hear you. Structured something freedom?
I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on the principle of structure gives you freedom.
What's the middle word in there? Structured what freedom?
Gives you freedom.
Oh, structure gives you freedom. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, thank you. And thank you for your patience there. If you don't have structure, movement, plan, engagement is kind of chaotic. If you have structure, you have a freedom to look at where you want to place your focus, what you want to do, and often principles inform a way of proceeding. So principles are creating a kind of structure. So if you look at the innovations that anyone does in any field, look at the innovations in science, the innovations in literature or the arts, someone knows the principles of the elements, has deconstructed and learned the way of going about constructing something so that creativity then has a meaning. Synthesis and integration have a meaning once you have a certain structure. And that's kind of a shorthand for the principles. For example, the way I go about coaching in terms of integrating psychology, neuroscience, quantum physics, and behavioral economics, sometimes neuroeconomics, with strategic coaching, it's the structure of my background. It's the structure of the principles from these experiences that inform what I do and what I can do in working with clients. Let me give you an example of that. I once worked as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst with an artist who was a regionally well-known artist. And he came to me, he wanted to kind of quieten his demons, but he was afraid that if he quietened his demons, his creativity would be lost. Now, what he found was just the opposite, that once he really had an understanding of himself and quietened his demons, he was free to be even more creative. So he had the internal structure to do that. An application, another related example, is he described how when he went to a canvas to emote, he was an abstract expressionist. When he went to a canvas to emote, he had a total immersion and freedom. He wasn't thinking about this line meant this, and this color meant this, and this form or this, you know, configuration meant this. He wasn't looking at symbolic meaning. He just emoted on canvas. He said, as I step back, after the process is over, I can look at each element and tell you from where in my 15 years of formal training of line drawing anatomy and all of that, for 15 years of training and then experience, that comes from. But when I'm in that zone, in the flow of doing that, I have the freedom because I have the structure inside of all of that training. So that's an illustration of what I mean. We do things as we engage with clients that we are totally immersed in the moment, in contingent conversation as we began this this discussion. But we are informed by all of the principles of the tools and methods and skills that we've developed as coaches so that we have the freedom to be immersed and engaged in that way. We don't have to be stepping back and wondering what we should be saying or what somebody would think, but that allows a total freedom and immersion. Does that make sense now?
Yes, thank you very much.
Terrific, great question. Thank you for raising that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I thought we'd have more time for discussion. If anything comes up, if anything has not been answered, shoot me an email or jot it down, and we'll begin right here next time to look at any unanswered questions and look at our final seminar. So thank you all very much. I appreciate the responses I've gotten, and I welcome them, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. Bye now.
You too.
See you guys.